This is Susan Hartman. Today is October 24th, 2013, and I'm interviewing Joan Huber, whose birth date is
10/17/25.
Okay, thank you. Let's just start out by you telling us, describing the positions that you held or the roles you played at Ohio State, in what units and over what time period.
I came here as Dean of Social and Behavioral Science in 1984, and I served until 1992. I became Provost in 1992 and retired from that position in 1993. I agreed to become Provost because the provost had suddenly left to be president of the University of Maine, and they needed to stick somebody in a hurry, and mm-hmm. there I was.
Mm-hmm.
So,
mm-hmm. Okay. Well, we'll get back to that, the position later. But first, I wonder if you could talk about what shaped your life as an academic, your career, your family, your background experiences, before you came to Ohio State?
Well, my four grandparents, not one of my four grandparents, got beyond the fourth grade.
Hmm.
All of them had migrated to this country between 1830 and 1850. Hmm. On my mother's side, they were Swiss Mennonites, and on my father's side, they were basically Church of the Brethren. Hmm. Both of those are peace churches, of course, which made a difference before World War II because they were pacifists.
Mm-hmm.
My father became an entomologist because he discovered he was allergic to horses. He'd come down to Ohio State in the College of Agriculture. He was a farm boy.
Hmm.
And he was going to be an extension agent, but he was allergic to horses, so he had to get a PhD instead. So he got it in entomology, and he worked at Worcester at the experiment station as an entomologist, and he considered himself a scientist. He was very strong in that respect. My mother was a high school graduate, but both she and my father had passed the Boxwell exam, which was some rigorous thing that Ohio kids took after they got through high school so they could teach.
So both
of them taught my mother taught grade school and my mm-hmm. father taught high school in the course of their lives.
And they both grew up in Ohio?
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm something like a sixth or seventh generation.
I didn't know that.
One of my great-great-great-great-grandfathers founded the city, Kidron, Ohio.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Huh. I didn't know that.
It's not Manhattan.
Right.
But anyway.
Okay.
My father was always interested in my twin sister and me with regard to our education. But I can remember one time when I was a sophomore in high school and I'd just come out first in world history in the state of Ohio.
Hmm.
And my teacher was a marvelous woman, and I told my father I would like to go into diplomatic service. And he said, well, that's a very fine occupation, but he said, your husband might die, and
mm-hmm.
you'd better take education so you'll have a job.
I got the same message.
But so there were things that could have been changed that might have been better. Anyway, I went to Penn State, and I got married when I was 20,
mm-hmm.
and I told my fiancé that I wanted to get a PhD. Oh, that's fine, he said. I said, you know, when the children we want are old enough, that's what I want.
Hmm.
Oh, that's just fine, that's just fine. And I didn't discover until much, much later that he didn't really mean it.
Hmm.
But at any rate, I got married at 20.
And you finished school?
Yeah, I finished undergraduate school in less than 2 years.
Wow.
I was in a hurry. I wanted to get to Radcliffe, and I got admitted in history, which was my first love and remains of great interest. My fiancé said, oh, if you go there, that'll be the end of us.
Hmm.
And he was right, and I made the wrong decision. So after 15 years of marriage, I finally got back to graduate school. By that time, the children were in fifth grade and seventh grade, respectively.
So you went to Radcliffe when you were married?
No, I didn't.
You didn't go?
I made the wrong decision.
Oh, okay.
I didn't go to Radcliffe in history. I stayed at Penn State, and I taught German, introductory German, 1, 2, and 3, for 2 years. Well, at least after that 2 years, I knew why I didn't want to stay in German. Mm-hmm. I wanted to be in something that, well, my father said it's a matter of just motivating them, but I'd like to see anybody motivate someone to learn the German subjunctive. Mm-hmm. And I preferred to go into a field where I care more about telling people what's going on.
Did you do anything else, any other kind of paid work when your children?
No.
Okay.
Oh, no. I was volunteer, mm-hmm. I was mm-hmm. president of the PTA and president of the AAUW and all that
mm-hmm.
stuff.
Mm-hmm.
My name was often on the woman's page with the cookie recipes. My husband finally moved to, I'll shorten some of this. He moved to Grand Haven, Michigan, which is on the shore of Lake Michigan, mm-hmm. just a lovely spot.
Yes.
And he worked at Brunswick. He was an organic chemist,
mm-hmm.
and whatever the goop is they put on bowling pins was what he knew how to make.
Hmm.
So, and I didn't want to go there.
You had been living in?
Coshocton.
Ohio. Okay.
Yeah, first we lived in Philadelphia for mm-hmm. 5 years mm-hmm. or 6 years. Something like that, and then Coshocton,
mm-hmm.
which was all right. The kids were still little, and mm-hmm. I couldn't have gone to graduate school anyway. But by this time,
mm-hmm.
My father had died, and I realized I'd better get going or I wouldn't get going at all. And I didn't want to move to Grand Haven, Michigan,
mm-hmm.
because you look at the map of Michigan, and Michigan State is 100 miles,
yeah.
and the University of Michigan is 150 miles.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I told him I didn't want to, but he pulled a suicide threat, and I collapsed.
Mm-hmm.
And so off we went to Grand Haven, Michigan. And I went to Michigan State. I put 100,000 miles on the car.
Wow.
And I only stayed overnight in East Lansing, I think, twice.
Mm-hmm.
And
your kids were teenagers by then?
Yeah, they were teenagers mm-hmm. by then.
And how many children did you?
Two
child.
Yeah, so it was quite, it was manageable.
Mm-hmm.
And I had, my husband had a good salary, and so I had household help. Someone came in and bailed me out.
Mm-hmm.
One day a week did the wash and cleaned and whatnot.
And this would have been in the 40s?
No. I started graduate school in 1961 or 62.
Okay.
So this is in the early, very early
60s. Okay.
And I got a master's at Western Michigan, and then I went on to Michigan State mm-hmm. in 1963, and in 67 I got a PhD.
Okay. That was fast.
Well, it was relatively fast,
yeah.
Yes. But I wasn't burdened by having to teach or anything like that, and I did get some federal money the last 2 years, I remember,
mm-hmm.
Paid for my dissertation and stuff. But as I say, money wasn't really a problem. I got divorced in 1969,
mm-hmm.
and by that time I was teaching at Notre Dame, which is 100 miles from Grand Haven also, but it's in a different direction,
mm-hmm.
but still in the snow belt. So I had some very...
You were doing all the commuting.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I was doing all the commuting. And so I was at Notre Dame for 4 years, and the first 2 years I was still married.
Mm-hmm.
And then I moved to Notre Dame, and that stopped the commuting. And so it was at Notre Dame that I became aware of the women's movement. I mean, I had always been sort of a closeted feminist because you don't get a PhD without having some kind of feelings along that line. But I became a whole hog feminist, and in 1971, I was one of 11 women that met at Yale in New Haven. I don't remember why we met at Yale. to form Sociologists for Women in Society, which was the descendant of the Women's Caucus in Sociology, and I was its second president. And so, so I was very much a feminist in those years, and especially at Illinois, because at Illinois, even the sociologists had to learn an awful lot. They learned fast, because sociology is, well, it has two major areas, social stratification, who gets what and why, and demography, who gets born and why and how long do they live. And it's these two things that are the heart of the discipline. So I was very much aware of social stratification, and I had been interested in poverty, and so I just switched to gender stratification. So at Illinois, I started teaching a course in gender stratification to undergraduates, and I've always preferred undergraduate teaching.
Can I just interrupt for a minute?
Yeah.
So what year did you leave Notre Dame for Illinois?
Oh, well, because I got married in 1971, I remarried.
Okay.
And that meant finding another job, and Notre Dame actually offered him a job.
Okay.
He was an academic also. Mm-hmm. But Illinois offered us a job, and both of us preferred Illinois. I mean, neither one of us was Catholic. Notre Dame is the top of the tree to Catholics, but if you're not Catholic, Illinois looks a little bit better as one of the Big Ten, so off we went to Illinois.
And you married Bill?
Yeah. Farm.
Bill Farm,
yeah.
Who eventually came here with you.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, yes. He was retired. He actually became emeritus from three Big Ten universities.
Really?
He shouldn't have been emeritus from here because Dieter Heinicke simply hired him because he could. I mean, you could, when you were retired, he could be a visiting professor, and so his status really was visiting here. And I don't see how you can be a visiting emeritus, but and that's not my problem.
So let me take you back to the early 1970s. You were involved in feminist activities in your profession through this organization for women in
sociology. It was a perfect fit for me because I never lost that interest.
And you, at the same time, you were teaching gender studies in sociology.
Well, yeah, I was teaching gender stratification. And the other course I taught in sociology that I just loved was introductory because,
you can put it in.
I mean, you can get, introductory really is about how did we get so stratified and, you know, race and all that stuff. And I've never lost my interest in it. Let's see. How do I see myself in terms of...
Just for factual purposes, tell us when you left Illinois and...
Well, I left Illinois in 1984.
Okay, so you were there.
And came here in 1984. At Illinois, I became their first director of women's studies. And then I became chair, or head, they had heads there, of the sociology department. And I was head of sociology when I was invited to come here as dean. And when I came for the first interview, I went back to Illinois and I said, don't worry, I'm not going there. And when I came for the second interview, all of a sudden I heard the drums beating and I decided it was time to move.
Who hired you here?
Dieter Heinicke was the provost. I admired Dieter a great deal.
You knew him, or you knew him.
Well, I don't know him well, but I knew him well enough to know that I thought he was a good provost and had the good academic vibes and all that sort of thing.
Did you think that you had wanted to go into administration before this opportunity?
Oh, I didn't really mind going into administration. I've always liked everything I did. I even enjoyed being a housewife.
That's great.
Someone said to me one time, well, it was in a snide way, something about how you like being a dean. And I said, look, I said, I like being a housewife, and if you like that, you can like anything. And that's true. I liked administration, and I really liked research, and when I was a department head, I didn't really have to give up my research. I managed, it was cut down, but not by very much. But being a dean, it just cuts it out. You just don't have time. And being a provost was just terrible. You don't even have time to read. But anyway, so I've always liked administration, and you learn things in administration, as you know, since you've done it, that you don't learn any other way. And you learn something about balance and about handling different interest groups.
Figuring out how to get things done.
Yeah.
And who to get to and how to get to him or
yeah,
her.
Who to get to and how to get to it done and how to survive. For example, I saw a friend of mine, a psychologist with very excellent credentials. She'd been at Michigan, she'd been at Princeton and so forth. And she became a Big Ten president. And she did not survive because she pushed feminism so hard against a bunch of people who were in the quote-unquote hard sciences with very little experience working with women and that sort of thing, because not enough women take math and not enough women go into science. And she didn't survive. And if you're going to survive in a very sexist atmosphere, you have to know how much social capital you've got and what you can use it for.
How much you can do, be realistic about it.
Because you can't do everything that some feminists think you can do like that. You just can't. So, anyway.
Okay, well, how do you... I had trouble answering this question myself. How do you generally identify yourself in terms of gender, race, sex, religion, class?
Well, I have no problem with gender. I'm a woman. And I know all about that, and I'm interested in that. And my primary research interest has always been, how did it come to be so? And I'll say more about that later, because you really have to include both biology and culture interacting all the time, or you don't come out with an answer. I feel very strongly about race, but... intellectually, of course, it's a mess of feathers, because skin color has nothing to do with what's in your head. And so that's all I can say. And, and when I'm asked, what is your race? Well, I say white, because I guess that's what I am. But I think it's the whole thing is stupid. But, of course... I won't give you a lecture on why black, what happened. Anyway, religion is very important to me, but I have to add that science is even more important if I had to rank them. And I can remember when I got confirmed in the Presbyterian Church at Worcester, and I said to my father, how can I confess that Jesus Christ is my Lord and Savior if I don't believe that? And he said, oh, poetry, poetry. I found that a very satisfactory answer. And I still have an answer that's very akin to that. I don't believe anything that science wouldn't say, yes, that's within the realm of possibility, and so forth and so forth. But science doesn't speak to moral problems. And when you have moral problems... I consider myself a Christian, not that I think it's perfect, but it's the best choice available to me now. And if you don't make a choice that somehow involves other people, it won't work. So I am an Episcopalian, and I manage to say the Athanasian Creed every Sunday because
poetry.
It's poetry. But I do, and that's another topic, but I do take these moral things very, very seriously, and that's the sense in which religion is important. I could never be an agnostic, because I think it's ridiculous for us humans to say that we will ever know God. Aldous Huxley said one time that the proof of the existence of God is Beethoven's 131st string quartet, or and I think that's true. And when I hear Mozart and Bach, that proves to me the existence of God, but you can never know God.
Right.
And so, that's where I leave
it. Well, let me ask you, you've touched on this in describing your background, but I don't know if there's anything else you might want to add about how being a female shaped your life. And if any other identities shaped
The female shaped my life in that I expected to have children, and sure enough, I had them. Mm-hmm. And I felt I had a great obligation to those children. And it would not, one was born in 49 and the other in 51. And my first husband would have a fit if I had tried to work. And it didn't occur to me to try to work anyway mm-hmm. when they were little because they were always sick. Mm-hmm. My son had bronchial asthma. Well, my daughter wasn't always sick, actually. She was really quite healthy. But she brought everything home from school, and then he'd get it. And I decided I couldn't do anything serious until after they'd both had measles. Mm-hmm. And that was true. They were dreadfully sick with measles. This was before the vaccine. Mm-hmm. And
so it certainly delayed your career.
Oh, it delayed it. Yeah, I'm roughly 15 years behind mm-hmm. my cohort. My true cohort was born in 1940. Mm-hmm. I was born in 1925.
Well, and I started graduate school in 1962. So
yeah. Mm-hmm. So that many of my friends, luckily for me, have been 15 years younger mm-hmm. than mm-hmm. I,
right.
which is handy when you get
right.
to as old as I am,
yes.
because so many of the people I knew are gone now.
Yes.
So,
any other ways do you think that being a woman shaped your life? Or
the whole idea of politics and who's on top and who's not on top, and it's very clear that women aren't on top.
Mm-hmm.
And that's shaped my life enormously.
Do you think you had to work harder to prove yourself? Did you feel
discrimination? Well, I had to work harder than men do because I had 15 years taking care of kids.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I lost 15 productive years. Mm-hmm. Now, according to what I think now, a couple of those years would have had to have been lost if you're going to have children. Mm-hmm.
But not that many.
The birth rate is now, well, actually, I think two, I was, my mother-in-law, who had been an immigrant herself, two is plenty, mm-hmm. so I heard that, mm-hmm. not from my own mother.
Mm-hmm.
She wouldn't have minded more, but.
Okay. Well.
That's a big deal, mm-hmm. and it's that 15 years that, that I lost.
Mm-hmm. And gained two children.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Did being a woman shape your experiences at Ohio State?
Well, by the time I got to Ohio State, I was pretty much what I am now. Mm-hmm. I mean, I was already teaching gender stratification, and I had very strong feelings about it. And by the time I got to Ohio State, most of the men in the humanities and the social sciences had already figured out that if they weren't basically feminist in their perspective, they'd better shut up.
Mm-hmm.
And they did.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I mean, there were some that I suspected weren't mm-hmm. totally feminist.
But were smart enough
not to say it. The only ones that would say it, and most of them by that time were smart enough not to say it out loud, or at least not to a woman, were in areas where women were very scarce.
Mm-hmm.
And mm-hmm. I've never known quite the extent to how it was in those areas because I never lived among those people mm-hmm. the way I lived among the social scientists and to some extent among the people in the humanities.
Mm-hmm.
But I was pretty much formed by the time I got here.
Do you think that, what about how you were treated and how you were able to do your job as dean and as provost? Do you think gender entered into that at all?
No, I don't think so. What entered into my job more than anything else was, and this was something that I became, well, I've always felt this way, but when you're a dean, you have to really act this way. And that is, you have to be very fair in your judgments on issues that are very hard to judge. Very few scholars are so unproductive or so productive mm-hmm. that you can say, oh, yes, or oh, no. Mm-hmm. There are many where, as you know, where the decision is very hard to make, and you really have to try and keep your personal feelings of fondness and that sort of mm-hmm. thing out of the picture. And it's very hard to tell somebody that you like and that you're fond of that you're very sorry, but they just haven't measured up. Mm-hmm. But as a dean, you have to do that. Mm-hmm. And I did think that there are, well, from my experience with sociologists and women for women in society, women are like men, and in that, if they don't quite measure up, they prefer to say, well, it's because I'm a woman, mm-hmm. or because mm-hmm. I'm this, or because I'm that. And some women, indeed, in my view, didn't measure up. Some of them didn't measure up. And the case was very hard to judge. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, some cases are very hard to judge, but you're just stuck. I mean, mm-hmm. if you're an administrator, you have to deal with them. And I did find that there were some feminists at Ohio State that were pretty uninsightful with regard to the problem of quality of publication mm-hmm. at a place like this. And since I came, the reason I came to Ohio State was that Ed Jennings convinced me he was finally going to try to put it on the map. Mm-hmm. I mean, for a long time, it had been basically a cow college. Mm-hmm. Well, part of that was that it had open admissions, and we flunked out half of our first quarter freshmen. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And you can't do that without demoralizing the faculty, mm-hmm. and especially demoralizing the poor students you're doing this to. Mm-hmm. And Ohio State has got, well, the quality of faculty here has improved a great deal in the last 40 years. Mm-hmm. And I came to Ohio State with the idea of doing that, and the department chairs in SBS, on the whole, were very sympathetic with that point of view. So I didn't get any flack from the department chairs. Mm-hmm. But there were women at Ohio State, of course, who didn't perceive those kinds of difficulties, and they would occasionally pick out a case of some woman, usually in some remote discipline, remote from me, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. and say, oh, and make a big do about it. But when I look at the vita, it didn't seem to me that there was really all that much there.
Mm-hmm. So, still talking about the climate then, do you think that there wasn't significant discrimination against women or racial minorities at Ohio State?
Oh, I think there had been, and there probably still is. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, there may be some to this day. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
But you didn't see it.
Oh no, I saw it. Yeah, mm-hmm. It was like at Illinois. There were women in the English department at Illinois, which prided itself on having quite a good English department, mm-hmm. Who had been taken, you know, they didn't quite have a PhD, but they were teaching, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. and teaching the courses the way we in the social sciences and the humanities get graduate students to teach our courses
right.
so we can get
right.
our beloved research
right.
done.
Mm-hmm.
And they would be doing things like that. And then after the women's movement dawned in 1970, I use dates like that because it's easier mm-hmm. when you're teaching introductory, they smelled the coffee and realized what they'd been doing. But they'd been doing it for so long that you couldn't do much about it.
Yeah, yeah.
And you've certainly experienced or known people in that fix yourself.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I've known people that were discriminated against.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And as far as I know, there was none of that in SBS while I was dean.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
What there had been before then, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
I have no doubt that there had been some.
Mm-hmm.
Because before people realized that you had to be fair about these kinds of things, And of course, the problem with women is that many of them came into the discipline late, as I did. And I can remember that the Danforth Fellowships were for people under age 35. Mm-hmm. Well, if you've had a couple of children and stayed home, you're too old for a Danforth, which I was. And that's one reason I remember the name Danforth. And Danforth was even an Episcopalian.
Yeah. I know Danforth well. I went to Washington University.
Oh, yeah, you must have.
Grew up in St. Louis, yeah.
Yeah, well, he was really a rather admirable man, considering Republicans of these days.
Well,
we should have more like
him. He was so far, considering today, he was so far to the left.
Oh, yeah. But in those, before 1970, everyone just took for granted that it was okay to have something that, you know, you just assume that women are home with the babies.
Right.
And you don't do anything.
Right.
And
what about the numbers or percentages of women faculty? Was that something that was identified as an issue then, or one that you
It's always been an issue. And as far as I'm concerned, it'll remain an issue until it's about 50-50. And, of course, there are some places where it's all women, and those people get paid less and all that sort of thing. I mean, the labor, well, anyway. What is needed, somewhere in here it asks what is needed. And what is needed will be a long time in coming, in my view. And that is that somehow you've got to make up to people who choose, well, two things. First, men have to be convinced that rearing children is as much their time responsibility as it is the mother's responsibility. And slowly, I think that's happening. Well, actually, it isn't all that slow when you consider how ingrained it was. It's actually been pretty fast.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, these days you see men wheeling babies in the, or kids in the cart at Kroger's and that sort of thing. There's been a big change in 40 years. But what is basically needed is to recompense those who choose to bear children from those who choose not to bear children. And this can only be done through a system of taxation. And You can't even persuade some people that poor people should, that the children of poor people should get food. Dear me, I mean, if I were God, believe me, things would look different.
So you really see women's childbearing role as the key limit.
Yeah, that's the key limit. And the reason was that until 1880, roughly, the 1880s, I should say, with the invention of modern medicine, when you learn that you have to wash your hands, you have to sterilize things, they invented a safe substitute for, relatively safe substitute for breast milk. Now, there's no doubt that breast milk is easier, is better for infants than bottled milk. But what's interesting, and what I learned only recently, is that the pattern of feeding infants was, until after the 1880s, was roughly every 15 minutes during the day. The baby with you. For hunter, women hunter and gatherers, the baby was always, you know, they'd make a sling or a sack or something, carry the baby with them, and it would feed, and then they slept with the baby at night to boot, where it didn't wake up quite as often. And humans are born, in effect, 3 months premature compared to our nearest cousins, the bonobos and the chimpanzees. And the reason they're born 3 months premature is that the brain kept enlarging and enlarging. And because we are bipedal, you can't keep enlarging that area and still be able to walk. I mean, it would be like walking in snowshoes. And so that birth is a social experience for women of necessity, because the birth, it's really too narrow. I mean, the Bible was right about that, but wrong about the fact that God did it. It was evolution that did it, and it's the cost of our large brain. And of course, it's a big price. It's a big price to pay. Mm-hmm. Now, what was I saying?
Okay. Well,
anyway,
we were talking about.
Go ahead.
Limitations on women and you know, sort of looking at why they're not represented in equal numbers in academia. And
well,
so forth.
they're getting to that point. Mm-hmm. Well, in the first place, academia has been in a severe state of depression for the last 30 or 40 years.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, right after World War II, oh boy, anybody could get a job.
Right.
I mean, I myself was teaching German right after World War II because they were short of teachers.
Mm-hmm.
But they haven't been short of teachers recently, and they still aren't.
Okay.
And jobs are hard to get, and mistakenly, the retirement age has been removed. I think it should be 70 in academia because academia is a profession so dependent on bringing
right,
in new
right.
ideas and
right.
new thoughts. But anyway, it's been
I
removed,
totally,
and
yeah.
you have to right. wait for these people to retire.
Right.
And so the huge baby boom clump is just beginning to retire now, and that will create some more positions. And in the very long run, of course, I think societies are going to have to worry about replacing themselves because bringing up a child is a lot of work, and the couple or the individual who does it is severely disadvantaged in many ways. And somehow we're going to have to recompense women. When it became possible to use the bottle, the use of the bottle crossed all class and race, any kind of stratification lines you want to talk
mm-hmm.
about.
Mm-hmm.
Women voted for the bottle.
Mm-hmm.
And what I started out saying was that now even those who breastfeed adopt the schedule of the bottle.
Mm-hmm.
That is, it's every
right.
3 hours,
yeah.
every
yeah.
4 hours,
yeah. Yeah.
something like
right.
that.
Yeah. That's
well,
right.
And the infant needed to be fed every fifth, almost continuously, and this is true of all primates.
Mm-hmm.
And only women have this problem of feeding infants that way. And male humans, unlike male primates, have the advantage of a big brain and the ability to talk.
Mm-hmm.
So while women are occupied with all this feeding and pregnancy stuff, men wrote all the laws.
Mm-hmm.
And they eventually wrote the laws so as to exclude women from practically everything that they wanted for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And so all these laws had to be undone. Well, a great many of them, as you know, are now undone. Whether all of them are undone, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Probably not, but some of the major ones certainly
mm-hmm.
are undone. And that's been a long time. But eventually I think we'll come to a world where academia is populated by people who are intellectually interested and able to do the work, and this will be men and women
mm-hmm.
equally.
Mm-hmm. Looking back on your deanship first, and then we'll talk about the provost, what did you see as the major challenges and major accomplishments? I know you talked a little bit about upgrading the quality of the faculty.
Well, that was the main
that
one.
That was sort of the key.
That was the key. That was the key thing that I hoped to do,
mm-hmm.
and it was that idea became important at Ohio State.
Mm-hmm.
Somewhere in that period, because other units started doing the
mm-hmm.
same thing,
mm-hmm.
or already had been doing the same thing.
Do you know if that brought more women in or not?
Well, it didn't keep women out.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know whether it brought more women in. I
mm-hmm.
wouldn't think it would.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't think it would have any effect on the proportion of women
mm-hmm.
brought
mm-hmm.
in, because actually women are entering graduate work in a bunch of different areas. I mean, if you go back 40 years, there weren't very many women graduate students in history or sociology or, you know, or
mm-hmm.
or English or any of those disciplines
mm-hmm.
50
mm-hmm.
years ago, and now there are lots of them. In
mm-hmm.
fact, some of them have feminized almost.
Mm-hmm.
So that some of those disciplines are going to get to the halfway mark
right.
on women
right.
very easily.
Just for the record, you were the first female
dean
at Ohio State.
Yeah, I was the first dean. Yeah.
Uh-huh. And did you, you didn't encounter any difficulties in dealing with people who reported to you and people who you reported with or your peers?
No, I didn't recall, and there were no difficulties with the people that reported to me, and that's probably because most people are smart enough not to tramp on a dean's toes. And I never concealed the fact that I was a feminist.
And
furthermore, the social sciences is an easy place to be working. Because by and large, social scientists are very much aware of the effect of social customs on what all of us believe and think and do and blah, 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 you know. So, no, I wasn't aware of that. But I'm sure that there were people across the university that would have offended me had they gotten close enough to me to do it. I mean, whoever said to me one time something about a deaness, and why don't you call yourself a deaness?
Oh, my goodness.
And I said, that's not a word in English.
Oh, my heavens.
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure there were stupid people out there, but they just didn't. I didn't come in contact with them. And by the time I was provost, people don't. People are less likely to insult the provost than they are other people. So I didn't get that. What they said behind my back, I wouldn't know.
And who was it that appointed you provost? Was that
Gordon
Key?
Yeah.
And you, but you didn't stay there very long.
Well, I couldn't. I mean, in the first place, I was, well, I was born in 1925.
Okay.
And when I retired, let's see, how old was I? 68 or 69, I can't remember. And I could have, at that point, I thought I was not going to have my voice. I had so much allergy and so much this and that and the other, and I would get laryngitis. Well, I was wrong. Apparently, retirement's good for my voice, and I can talk and talk. And now I wish I had stayed on to teach introductory soc for another 10 years. I could have. I mean, I couldn't do it now. I mean, now I really am too old. But I could have done it until I was 80. And that would have been fun, and I wish I had. But on the other hand, my husband's 8 years older. And if we're going to do anything together, we got to do it. You really have to do it before you're 85, because after that, you really start to get old. So,
were there any big particular challenges while you were provost, or?
No, I don't remember that. Well, there should have been, but there couldn't be. Let me clarify that. The med school badly needed something done to it. And I knew I wasn't going to be there very long because I told Gordon as soon as the committee came up with a plausible successor, an agreeable successor, I would just simply retire, or else retire as provost anyway. And so I didn't really try to do anything with the College of Medicine. I just went on.
Let it be.
And I behaved the way I had always behaved with humanities and SBS. And almost that way with the rest of the campus. But being provost is so far removed from particular disciplines that, you know, in SBS, I'm not a political scientist, but I don't feel ignorant in it. And I'm not an historian, but I don't feel ignorant in it. But I feel ignorant in some of the hard sciences.
I understand that. Okay. Did you get the second? Did you look at the second page of question? The most powerful experience you had at Ohio State.
I don't know. I haven't. I was unable to decide that.
I couldn't either. I said it was my retirement.
Well, I just couldn't. I didn't think in those terms. And did I work to affect institutional change? Yeah, I did. All the time. And can you talk about allies who supported change? Well, by the time I got here, I knew who my allies were.
Even before you got here?
Well, my allies are very strong in the social sciences, mm-hmm. and less so, I think, in history, because history had a lot of people who were so used to the idea that women weren't doing mm-hmm. anything mm-hmm. that mattered, mm-hmm. that it was hard for them to get over. It was mm-hmm. easier in the social sciences, because that's contemporary.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. This project is particularly interested in equity issues.
Yeah.
And so were you involved in, or did you see, could you identify other people who you thought were promoting equity issues?
Well,
either
yeah,
in terms
I could.
Of race or gender?
Well, the chairs, all of the chairs in SBS were very strong equity issues with regard to race. Mm-hmm. And they led me to believe that they were strong with regard to gender. Mm-hmm. And some of them were actually truthful in that respect.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure that all of them, I had my doubts about one or two of them, and they were in weak disciplines, but at least the people in the strong areas were no problem.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It was hard to, in some of those areas, it was much harder than it had been in sociology to find mm-hmm. women, because there were fewer women graduate students mm-hmm. for various kinds of reasons.
Mm-hmm.
Econ, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, econ kind of has a problem in that economists look really only at rational behavior, and they wipe out emotional mm-hmm. behavior, which mm-hmm. means that they're only about half right,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
if you can express it that way.
Or, yeah.
You know, or
yeah.
half wrong.
Yeah, yeah. Either when you left the university or now, what do you think remains undone relative to the progress of women and other diverse groups? We've talked a little bit about this already, I think.
You mean in other diverse university groups?
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
There
are times when I really feel that what would help is a good, strong dean, and it might have to be a woman, but I don't see why it would have to be a woman, simply knocking the heads of some of these people together when they make sexist remarks in faculty meetings, mm-hmm. when they get obstreperous with regard to hiring women and that sort of thing. And mm-hmm. I'm sure things that I wouldn't like go on in areas mm-hmm. that I'm not responsible for
yeah.
and don't
yeah.
see.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I know that I have... Well, I have long wished that somebody would get into the math department and knock a few heads together.
Mm-hmm.
I knew enough about the department to feel that there was some behavior there that I disapproved of very strongly.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Oh, goodness. One faculty member woman told me one time that when she got pregnant, they used to pat her stomach.
Oh my God.
This was before I came here, so mm-hmm. it must have been in the 70s mm-hmm. or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
mm-hmm.
anyway, I'm sure that things like that are going on that I didn't know about.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Anything else that? Any other kinds of changes that you think would promote the progress of women and other minorities, sexual minorities, racial minorities?
No, the main game is for people to do satisfactory research.
Mm-hmm.
And this is assuming that they are satisfactory teachers, but I have heard it said, and I'm inclined to believe, that it's easier to be a good teacher than it is to be a good researcher. Good teachers are more common than good researchers.
Mm-hmm.
And what you want, of course, is someone that's good at both, and this is hard to find. And if you find a terribly good researcher, sometimes you tend to forget about the teaching, but you can never forget about the teaching because this is not a research institute, it's a teaching institution. But you have to balance those things as best you can.
I'm surprised to hear you say that this is not a research but a teaching institution.
Oh, well, I had a faculty member in SBS. Well, she was a faculty member in SBS, and she got an offer from a very elite university. I'm trying to avoid naming names. And she had a joint appointment with a college outside of liberal arts and sciences, and that joint appointment permitted her to do no teaching, and she wanted sociology also to permit her to do no teaching. And I went up in smoke, and I said, you can't do that. I approve of people, it's complicated, I approve of people buying off half of their teaching time, but I do not approve of anyone ever buying off more than half of the teaching time, because some of those people, anyway, spend their teaching time on graduate courses with about five students.
Right.
And no, you can't do that. This is a teaching institution. But you know how complicated it is, because we want two things, and you've got to have some of both.
And we tend to hire people on the basis of their research.
Well,
we look for research stars.
We look for research, but I think that's the place to look hardest, because that's the rare, that's the more rare skill. And teaching, especially if you let them teach graduate courses, and you know, just sit there with some smart graduate students, if they're not good at that, then they shouldn't be hired at all. But it's hard to find a scholar who is uninterested. At least in my experience, most people who are real scholars like graduate students who are, because the graduate students are interested in them.
And they can focus them on what they're interested in.
Yeah, so it usually, usually you can solve those kinds of problems.
Yeah.
Actually, it's hard to find somebody that likes teaching Soc 100. That's, but I loved it.
I always loved the introductory history
course. Yeah, it's. I used to have 503 kids in my class in Illinois, and
wow, I never had that.
The auditorium held 503. It was just, I loved it. And that's. I'm really sorry I didn't go back to it when I retired.
When you retired, are there any topics that you want to talk about that we haven't covered?
I can't think of any. Oh dear, there's so much left undone on the progress of women. My experience, maybe I'm too optimistic, but I'm really very hopeful that over time enough women will go into math and that kind of stuff that, and we'll be interested in engineering and that sort of thing. Because I do think our brains are the same as men's in this respect. And I really regret that more, you know, people are trying to do this now, so, but we'll have to wait 20 years to see how it works out. Because if you don't learn math, you bar yourself from so many things. The last thing I suppose I could say is that I have been very disappointed in my own discipline by the number of women in it who are devoted to the idea that that human behavior is simply the product of culture and has nothing to do with biology. Because the heart of women's problem is that it's both biology and culture. It started out being biology, and then technology came along and enabled men to do all sorts of, you know, great things, and enabled women to do those same kind of great things. And then you can feed babies, The real problem for the future is how you make it up to these babies that are born prematurely 15-minute feedings for 3 months
mm-hmm.
or for almost the first year.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know how to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not even seen as a problem. When my children were born, even Spock, who was really very kind and child-oriented, said, you know, you can let them cry it out. It won't hurt them. This kid just born and from a line of primates that's used to being fed almost continuously,
mm-hmm.
and it's hungry,
mm-hmm.
and you're letting it cry?
Mm-hmm.
But no one knows that yet,
mm-hmm.
because the people who would make it known, which are women, have chosen to believe that it's only culture, and you can never explain that.
Mm-hmm.
And there's been a woman, she's a good friend of mine, who was president of the ASA a few years ago.
American Sociological
yeah.
Association.
And it's only culture, it's only culture.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a disappointment, because if the women in sociology were all aware of the fact that biology is behind it, they maybe.
But I think you said earlier that it's only for a year.
Well,
or so that
by the time a child is a year old, it wouldn't have to be fed every 15 minutes. It can go much longer. But how this business of every 15 minutes for roughly the first year.
But nobody does it anymore.
No, that's right. The people that breastfeed don't do it, and
mm-hmm.
the people that bottle feed don't
mm-hmm.
do it.
Mm-hmm.
No one does it.
Mm-hmm.
Something that that's lasted millions of years amongst primates
mm-hmm.
is gone in a century.
Mm-hmm.
And we're unaware of it. We just let them cry it out.
Mm-hmm.
And somehow it doesn't seem right.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's the kid may be able to get used to not being handled every 15 minutes, but if it's hungry, it's hungry.
Mm-hmm.
And I think not feeding children, infants and children, is probably one of the worst sins that we humans,
mm-hmm.
adults, can commit. So I'll think of more later. It always happens. But
well, you can add, when you get the transcript, you can add something. Do you have any memorabilia that you might be willing to give to the archives to copy?
Like what?
Oh, I don't know. Letters, memos.
Oh,
reports,
I probably don't, because I sent all my stuff. I bundled up and sent to the archives at
Penn
State.
When you left your office, right. Oh.
And, well, Penn State took all the ASA stuff.
Okay.
Now, I still have some stuff in my office that Penn State sent back, and I expect that what it is the letters, some of the, it might include, and I haven't opened it yet.
Mm-hmm.
I just, sufficient end of the day, and I'm trying to meet a deadline in publication. It may have a bunch of letters I wrote to Frank Stanton, which were very carefully written because that was for development, and I liked him anyway.
Journalism, for supporting the journalism?
No, Frank supported psychology.
Oh, okay.
His degree was in psychology.
It
didn't really, anyway, there are those letters, and I don't know what else.
Well, if you see anything,
All right, because those letters, some of those letters, I remember one of the letters contains stuff, I think it was from when I was provost.
Mm-hmm.
Or no, I wasn't provost. I was retired, and Dick Sisson was provost.
Mm-hmm.
And they were having a sit-in on the second floor of Bricker Hall. I can't remember what the issue was, but the second floor really smelled.
Was that when the service workers went on strike?
It might have been.
Mm-hmm.
I just don't remember.
Mm-hmm.
But it was students and,
mm-hmm.
and so forth, and Sisson left town. And Gordon was, whoever was president then, and it wasn't Gordon.
If it was the strike, it would have been Kerwin.
It was Kerwin.
Yeah.
He was out of town.
Yeah.
He was the one that let Bricker Hall be invaded.
Mm.
And then, yeah, by that time I was, my office was still in Bricker, I don't remember where it was, in the building.
Mm-hmm.
And I resented the fact that Kerwin let Bricker be invaded and then went off
mm-hmm.
and left the rest of us to mm-hmm. crawl over all these people.
Yeah, because there were picket lines in front of the
Yeah, that was it. That must have been it.
Yeah, that was a strike, yeah.
Yeah, I didn't like that. And I wrote Frank Stanton about that.
Hmm.
Yes, I remember for some reason. Well, I hope I can retrieve that
letter. Well, those
letters
would be, I think the archives would be interested in copying them.
Yeah, they probably would be. I'll see. I hope I just live long enough. I'm going to get what I'm working on now off before I do anything
mm-hmm.
else, but I will see if I have anything
there.
I got to look through it anyway because I can't leave my daughter to go through all that junk.
Right.
So.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, well, this has been really enjoyable for me, and as I said, you'll have a chance to look at it. So.
Well, it was. I'm glad that you were my interviewer because... I'm not going to open that.
Oh, good.
No, no,
I'll take
I'll
it
get,
with you.
Yeah, I'll get. Well, all right, I'll take it with me.
Should I turn this off? Or?
Well, if I'm going to take it with me,
should I turn this off? Or?
Oh.
Yes.